Our next case is number 25-1281, United States versus Michael Bragg. We have our supervisor first, please.
Indeed. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kate Stetson. I am here in my capacity as the supervising attorney for the University of Virginia School of Law Appellate Litigation Clinic. It's my privilege to introduce to you two recent graduates of the law school, Andrew Odell and Alexander Mehta. Mr. Odell will be presenting opening argument, Mr. Mehta, the rebuttal. We thank you for this opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Stetson, for supervising them. Mr. Odell, take a moment, and whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andrew Odell for Appellant Michael Bragg. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my colleague, Mr. Mehta, on rebuttal. Mr. Bragg's counsel was ineffective in violation of the Sixth Amendment. Counsel's performance was deficient. There was a good argument available that Mr. Bragg's pending state charges in Cumberland County were relevant conduct to the federal offenses. In that instance, 5G1.3C recommends that the federal charges be imposed concurrent with the anticipated state sentence and not the consecutive sentence that Mr. Bragg received. But counsel did not make that argument. That deficiency prejudiced Mr. Bragg. The Supreme Court has made clear that an error in calculating the guidelines range at sentencing is almost always enough to demonstrate a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
Okay, if the judge in fact made an error. But for Strickland prejudice, you also have to show that it's reasonably likely that the district judge would have accepted this argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I have real doubts that the district judge would have accepted this argument. So we have two groups of charges. The federal charges are ultimately pleads to child pornography manufacture. And then there's, you know, the one set of charges that are the images that he made with his daughter, the neighbor's daughter at home, the sexual assault, et cetera, and those were grouped. So for this to make a difference, you'd have to show a reasonable probability that the judge would have accepted this argument and imposed concurrent rather than consecutive sentences as to the Cumberland County charges. Those were ones he made at work, at the hospital, with patients, you know, sexually assaulting them, taking pictures of them, et cetera. They're different victims. Gravamen of the harm is different. It seems very unlikely that the district court would have accepted this argument as to Cumberland County. So explain to me why there's at least a reasonable probability that the court would have accepted that argument.
Yes, Your Honor, there's a couple of threads to tease apart there. But I think that the best evidence that we can point to is in the record what the judge did when 5G1.3C applied, and that's he applied the provision. As Your Honor points out, he applied it to the Franklin County charges there and ran the sentence concurrent with those charges.
Okay, but there was a really strong argument that those get grouped together. They're, you know, same place, same time, et cetera. Here, this is different. The hospital charges appear to stretch back 2 years, well before the Franklin County and federal, the time period that is charged in the federal indictments, just what, 2019, the hospital stuff goes back to 2017, and we have completely different victims, too.
That's right, Your Honor. The Cumberland County does go back to 2017, the Cumberland County conduct, but some of the federal charges start in the summer of 2018, and Mr. Bragg's whole point is that this should be considered relevant conduct because it all describes the same course of conduct here, and that's abusing his authority by surreptitiously recording victims that were placed in positions of trust by him. And each recording was a testing to bounce for the next. It expanded his illicit collection that he was amassing, and it reinforced the pattern. It encouraged further recording.
But the sexual assaults at the hospital are not part of amassing a collection.
Your Honor, he was facing assault charges in Cumberland County, that's correct.
Yes.
But a large majority of the charges, even those listed by the PSR, He was facing invasions of privacy for surreptitiously recording victims.
Right.
We think that that expands the universe of what is considered relevant conduct here because of the charges that were pressed in Cumberland County.
Okay, but that seems to make them of a same or similar character, not necessarily of a common scheme or plan.
And Your Honor, Mr. Bragg, I'm sorry, Your Honor, maybe the best evidence here is what the government said at sentencing. The government certainly seemed to think that the Cumberland County conduct was relevant to the sentence that the court was going to impose in the federal matters. The government urged consideration of that conduct. This is all on JA 153 to 154. They said that Mr. Bragg, quote, engaged in predatory behavior at a high level for a very long period of time, end quote. The government described a high degree of consistency between the Cumberland County conduct and the federal conduct. It said that he was, quote, pretty consistent in each of these situations, end quote, and that he used his position of authority as, quote, father, neighbor, and nurse, end quote, to abuse the trust of his victims. The government also described a common MO here, how he was, quote, surreptitiously recording victims as they were undressing in the hospital, end quote. And then the government noted the common victim profiles here, noting that there were child victims both in Cumberland County and in the federal offenses. So we think that some of the best evidence here about relevant conduct is what the government saw fit to talk about. And the overarching point, I think, is that the government shouldn't get to have its cake and eat it too when it comes to determining relevant conduct. It's fine that that came in to enhance the sentence here or to inform the sentence, but then it should also be considered where the guidelines direct that it be considered, and that's in 5G1.3C. And the fundamental purpose of that provision is to avoid double punishment. And our whole argument is that by failing to make the argument, Mr. Bragg's counsel did not put the district court on notice that there was even the potential for an overlap here.
How's it double punishment if there are different victims? At a high level, ironically, your argument is basically the more that he did these terrible things, the less likely it is that he should be sentenced consecutively for them. So, I mean, just because he had more victims, it's just he did the same thing. Why does that not equate to a longer sentence?
Your Honor, at the end of the day, this could go back to the district court, and the district court could impose the same sentence. But to show, all we have to do is show a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
And the way the grouping rules work in the sentencing guidelines, when we're talking about offenses where the sentence is basically determined by the dollar value stolen or defrauded, or the amount of drugs possessed or sold, the grouping rules very readily add all those things up. But in violent offenses, the guidelines generally don't add up separate victims and say you get a discount for three kidnappings rather than three times one kidnapping, right? This is a human victim offense. It's not a dollars offense. It's not a drugs offense or something like that. It's the number of women and girls harmed here. And so why should we treat it like it's just adding up a dollars offense? That's not the way the grouping rules work across the guidelines.
That's true, Your Honor. And, you know, we could tease out the counts 1, 2, and 5, which are clearly not groupable and were not grouped at sentencing, with counts 3 and 4, which were grouped. And we don't think that we're asking the court to treat or to minimize harm to the victims. But what we are asking is that, what we're urging is that counsel's deficiency here just did not inform the district court that there is even the possibility of some overlap in the conduct between Cumberland and federal charges. And again, we go back to, I offered what the district court did when it applied. There's also what he said at sentencing, which is that the district court said that it thought that the sentence that it was imposing was what was reasonable and reasonable and sufficient, but not more than necessary to punish the conduct at issue in the federal charges. That's a fundamentally different rationale than the district court ended up offering in denying the 2255, where the district court said that the sentence imposed was not sufficient to account for the federal conduct. And so we think that the district court's statement here that it would have done the same thing has to be read in light of that inconsistency. And we think that the Molina-Martinez presumption should not be trumped by that kind of inconsistent statement.
Why is this deficient when there's only one offense of conviction here and you rely on 1B1.2 to say that plea counts basically are treated as offenses of conviction, but it explicitly applies to Chapter 2. This is Chapter 5. So it seems to me it would have, I mean, there would have to be, for us to say this falls below the level of any reasonable assistance of counsel, that it would have to be clear that, to your point, this groups with counts that were not actually the offenses of conviction, that somehow 1B1.2, despite being a Chapter 2 application, also applies to Chapter 5, which isn't a bad argument, but I'm not sure that faulting someone for making that, for not making that argument, falls below the standard of performance that one expects of effective assistance of counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. There's two or three threads that I'd like to try to tease apart. The first one is what counts as the offense of conviction. Mr. Beck's plea agreement stipulated to the commission of the federal conduct underlying all five counts.
Right.
1B1.2C says that we apply the guidelines at sentencing as if convicted of all counts.
For Chapter 2 purposes.
Okay, I understand the question, Your Honor.
Why would it be clear that that has impact on Chapter 5? I mean, it's not a bad argument, but I'm just not sure that it falls to the level of deficient performance when, to me, that's not clear in any case law or the guidelines themselves that it applies to anything beyond Chapter 2.
May I continue? Yes, Your Honor, there's two cases that I could point you to. There's Olmeda, which is flagged in the Certificate of Appealability, and then there's the D.C. Circuit's decision in Brown, and we briefed both of those. And both of those cases, Olmeda says that calculating 5G1.3C is akin to calculating the guidelines range, that Chapter 2 thing that you're talking about. And then Brown specifically says that it is the same thing. And so we think that there's no coherent explanation for why we would treat the offense of conviction differently.
That's a good argument of why we should adopt that position, but I'm asking why is not making that argument deficient performance?
So the standard in this circuit is that counsel has to raise arguments that are arguably available, and it has to do the research and look for out-of-circuit cases. And so both of these decisions would have been available to Mr. Bragg's counsel at the time, and there's really no reason not to press this particular argument.
Thank you, Mr. O'Dell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bannon, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Patrick Bannon on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin with the prejudice prong and Judge Bevis, specifically your question about doubting whether this 5G1.3C would apply in this case and whether there would be a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And I think even before getting into the discussion of the grouping analysis or the applicability of this provision of the guidelines at all, I think the district court addressed squarely whether there was a reasonable probability of a different outcome in its decision denying the motion and said that it would have imposed the same sentence as it did and gave its reasons why it would.
And it's the same judge.
And it's the same judge who presided over the sentence, Judge Connor.
But in evaluating prejudice, can we look at a post-sentencing statement? It seems like we'd be, for prejudice purposes, maybe if you're talking about harmless error, but if we're talking about prejudice, it seems like we'd be confined to the record at sentencing.
Well, I think the way that courts have addressed the Section 2255 decisions have found that the statements of the district court in denying 2255 motion for that reason, that this sentence would have been opposed, are often, very instructive in addressing the reasonable probability analysis. So we cited to the Matthew case from the Fifth Circuit in our brief that collects a number of cases from other circuits that, held exactly that such statements, do have bearing on whether there's a reasonable probability, especially whereas here you had the same judge. And I think, another case from the Fourth Circuit, United States v. Powell, the court said directly, relevant to our Strickland prong two analysis, such statements provide valuable and informed insight into what the court would have done had counsel acted as the defendant claims he should have. But I think, the argument from Mr. Bragg that the district court's statement of what it would have done should be just disregarded. I don't think it leaves the district courts able to address Section 2255 motions like this one, where it has to address whether there's a reasonable probability of, you know, a different outcome and what it would have been, you know, had the argument been raised, which is exactly what the district court decided here. So I think, you know, just in terms of, you know, the prejudice analysis, I think even before we get to the merits of the 5G 1.C3 argument that this provision can apply to the offenses of conviction, I think, you know, first, the district court's decision in saying that it would have applied this sentence regardless of the argument being raised. And also, I mean, the concurrence point was made at sentencing. Counsel did request a concurrence sentence. They requested a mandatory minimum sentence as well. And the judge, you know, did not agree with either of those. And, you know, so the district court revisiting, you know, on collateral review, what it did in sentencing is consistent with the ruling that it initially made at sentencing to impose this consecutive sentence based specifically on, you know, the conduct at issue. And I'm happy to address any questions related to the, you know, the merits of the grouping analysis, but I think Judge Bibas, to your point about whether this even would apply had counsel raised it, you know, I think based on, first of all, the grouping issue that these are offenses in Cumberland County against the person, you know, assaults and production charges, if those charges had been adopted federally, they would not have been grouped for prosecution, you know, the assault charges, the production charges in Cumberland County. And then even after the grouping analysis, you get into whether or not it's relevant conduct. And I think in our brief, we cite to a number of cases from this and other courts like Winden that found that this type of conduct is not relevant conduct. So I think there's a number of arguments as to why, even after looking at the district court's analysis in its order, why, you know, the argument wouldn't apply, or why the second 5G 1.3C would not apply here. And if there's nothing further, I'm happy to see that. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mehta, I believe you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to make 2 points on rebuttal, one about deficient performance and one about prejudice. The government talked about how Mr. Bragg's counsel properly raised the argument, and we just want to be clear that we do not think that counsel came close to the standard that this court requires. The standard for competent counsel would have been to raise an arguably available objection, and that includes raising out-of-circuit authority, distinguishing adverse cases. And for instance, in Headley, this court found deficient performance even though it wasn't clear that the provision actually applied. So we think that the fact that Omeda was on the books and Brown was on the books, making clear that the principle from Molina Martinez applied exactly the same for the purposes of Chapter 5G 1.3C, would have alerted counsel to that. And what he needed to actually do was put the district court on notice that 5G 1.3C applied to Cumberland in the same way as Franklin did, and that the different application, and specifically that the background commentary suggestion for Cumberland was error. And
so your point is that there's competency only if a particular argument is raised in a particular way, because I'm looking at Strickland itself establishing an ineffective assistance of counsel, and it suggests the standard is that the counsel is so deficient that there's not even the possibility, basically, of a fair trial, or that there's not a reliable just result. So talk to me about how that matches with your argument right here.
Sure, Your Honor. We think that standard is not met because for the purposes of Mr. Brown's sentencing, there would be no strategic justification, no reason at all to not raise this argument where counsel had raised other objections that were less meritorious. Counsel had raised two level enhancements, even though
wouldn't the burden be on him to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence, which might be fraught with peril for Mr. Bragg?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Incumbent upon the person raising the argument, meaning Mr. Bragg's attorney, to prove that it is applicable by a preponderance of the evidence, and that in doing so, that might be fraught with peril for Mr. Bragg? In other words, he'd have to introduce details of how many of the victims were children and what the conduct was and how many were adults, and that could impact his offense, although he does seem to have maxed out on his guidelines for the counts that you say it grouped with. But it just seems like to say that there's no strategic reason when he had the burden of showing it's applicable, I don't know. That could be a problem for Mr. Brennan.
I take the point, Your Honor, that it could have been a problem, but we don't think that's true here. First, because of the extent that the government discussed the conduct, as my colleague already mentioned, they discussed not only the common MO of him abusing his trust, but the government even began their discussion by saying that one of the biggest problems for them was that he hadn't yet apologized for his conduct as a nurse. And so our point is that if that conduct was truly completely unrelated, then there would have been no reason for the government to bring it up. And after Mr. Bragg's counsel saw the government discuss it for so long, that should have alerted him to the fact that he needs to...
But that's different than saying there's no strategic reason.
Well, we also think that there's no strategic reason because of the magnitude that raising this argument would have had on his client's sentence, and because of the fact that in a letter to his client over a year before sentencing, he had already expressed to Mr. Bragg that he was aware of the provision and that it seemed like that conduct was going to be accounted for in his federal sentence. And we know that the plea is not an issue here, but we think that that also demonstrates that this wasn't a case of strategy. We think this is just a case of a lack of diligence. If I could, I'd like to also turn to the prejudice point and why we think we should discount the district court statement. To be clear, we're not saying that the statement has no weight. We're just saying that it's not dispositive and that it doesn't overcome the presumption that Melina Martinez and Almeida and Brown make, which is to say that 5G 1.3C is the proper starting point. And prejudice just means showing a reasonable probability of a different outcome. It doesn't mean that the judge would have had to actually run the sentence concurrent. We just think that there's enough in the record to show that had the district court known that the provision could have applied to Cumberland, he would have at least started there as the correct starting point, which many cases in this court, not just in the Strickland context, but in the plain error context and also in the procedural error context, show that getting the right starting point means starting with the presumption of concurrency and then reasoning away. And we think the fact that when that provision was actually flagged to the judge and he applied it demonstrates that. And many of the other cases that the government cites where such a statement was given credit are cases where the court actually looks at if the provision applies and says one way or the other whether that would have been true, which isn't the case here.
Don't the things that the district judge said, the sentencing judge said, strongly imply the sentencing judge wanted a pretty severe sentence? This is not someone who's looking at for a way to impose severity. Leniency, I thought the person, he hadn't accepted responsibility, everything else. You're saying, well, if he'd bought this argument, he would have known he had a way to be lenient, but he knew he had discretion. It's a discretionary provision, and he's not looking for a way of leniency. So, and the guidelines are advisory to begin with. So why should that matter?
Two responses, Your Honor. So first, him saying that he seemed to think this conduct was so egregious, part of our point is he didn't say that exactly at sentencing. At sentencing, he said that a sentence within the guidelines range was appropriate but not greater than necessary. It's only on the denial motion that the district court now says that a sentencing guidelines, within guidelines range sentence, sorry, was not appropriate and that is what justified the consecutive sentence. So
are we allowed to, why can't we put weight on that?
You can put weight on it, Your Honor, but there are other cases in this circuit, but we think of Smalley, for instance, but then also out-of-circuit cases as well, where those statements get that kind of credit when it's a consistent rationale, essentially, between the first instance and the second instance, and that's not what actually happened here. So if there are no further questions, Your Honor, then we respectfully ask that you remand and resentence, and at the very least, we think Mr. Bragg is owed an evidentiary hearing to resolve the open questions of, for instance, if there's overlap or strategy. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'd like to thank both sides for the very helpful briefing and oral argument. A special thanks to the University of Virginia Appellate Litigation Clinic for their service to this court, to Ms. Stetson for supervision, and congratulations to both our advocates on their law school graduation and first, presumably, oral arguments. Let's go off the record briefly and congratulate all counsel over here at Sidebar.